Hello and welcome to the podcast of 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom, not just information and platitudes, to an international audience of rising leaders. My name is Jeffrey Wang, the founder of Professional Development Forum and your host. The podcast is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, which helps diverse young professionals of any age to find fulfillment in the modern workplace. On this podcast, you'll hear honest, practical advice that you cannot learn from a textbook. Today's guest is Rod Mewing. Rod has over 40 years' experience in senior executive and management roles. He's currently providing strategic consulting, executive coaching, mentoring, and group facilitation with the Executive Connection, also known as TEC. Rod had a meteoric rise earlier in his career. In his 30s, he was appointed the managing director of David Jones, Australia's leading premium retailer. He was also the CEO of Tempo Services. His most recent corporate role was at Telstra, Australia's largest telco, as the principal business consultant. He has served on numerous industry and community boards, including Tempo Services, Woolworths, David Jones, and the New South Wales Economic Strategic Development Committee. And Rod is also the immediate past chairman of Hammond Care and Hammond Care Health and Hospitals Limited. Mate, that is quite a resume, Rod. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good morning. Nice to be with you.
I'll start with the first business lesson that you've learnt.
Yes, well, the first one, and it may sound a bit of a cliche, but certainly in my career, it's been an important one, and that is to always under-promise and over-deliver. Over my 40 years in business, typically it's been in relation to serving customers, and I remember my first responsibility for a profit and loss business was running a concrete plant in Canberra back in the late 70s. I was at the age of 24. And I learned a lesson very clearly then to always be totally open and transparent with your customer. If the concrete is running late, then you've got to fess up and tell the concrete layer or placer it's running late. And I learned that lesson at the age of 24 by being absolutely berated by customers who were waiting for their concrete and weren't given the proper information. Yeah, but the same lesson has followed me through my career, Jeffrey, into retailing. Always ensure that if you create an expectation with customers coming into your store, you've got to meet that expectation. Otherwise, you've wasted all of your marketing spend and you alienate the customer. Mm-hmm. And typically, the customer will not come back to your business.
And why is that so important?
Oh, only in terms of loyalty of customer. I mean, the real long-term meaningful relationship with customers is built around trust. Mm-hmm. And if you breach that trust by not delivering on the expectations of the customer, then typically you've lost that customer for many, many years. And it's always much, much harder to develop new relationships as opposed to maintaining existing relationships with customers.
So one could say that there are so many people in the world. Why is it so important to have credibility to the people that you deal with on a day in, day out basis?
As I say, Jeffrey, your credibility is built around you delivering mm-hmm. on the promise that you make or the expectation that you create with the customer. And whilst I grant you it's a big customer and there are plenty of fish in the ocean, if you are going to build a sustainable business built around a reputation, built around the opportunity for customers to refer your business to mm-hmm. other customers, yep. it is a far more cost-effective, a far more sustainable model than just going out there fishing, looking for new customers. And if you don't have that credibility and you don't develop that trust, then you're not going to get referrals and you're not going to get loyalty amongst your customer base.
Absolutely. So as the old saying goes, a happy customer tells 10 people and an unhappy customer tells 100.
Exactly. Totally right.
All right. So number two, you've got think like a customer. Can you tell me what that means?
Yes, well, as you mentioned, Jeffrey, I spent quite a number of years in the retailing sector. I was visiting a US-based retailer called Nordstrom, and this was back in the early 80s. And I was sitting with one of their vice presidents at his boardroom table, and he had a simple table tent on the table that said, think like a customer. As a mantra in the retailing industry, it is absolutely critical that everyone from the shop floor all the way through the boardroom have this serious commitment to customer centricity. So when I came back to Sydney, I had, I think it was about 120 of these Perspect table tents made, and I distributed them to each of the management layers throughout the organization and asked them to put it on their desk. And if in doubt, in terms of dealing with a customer-related issue, refer to the table tent that simply said, think like a customer. And that basically was the mantra of the organization back in the 80s and early 90s, was to ensure that the customer service, the quality of the relationship, put the customer at the center of everything the organization did. So it was a simple way of just reinforcing that message and that culture throughout the entire organization. But it stayed with me through my time in telecommunications, my time with consumer products. If you put the customer at the center of everything that the organization does, then typically you're more likely to be making correct decisions as opposed to incorrect decisions. And it's certainly been something that maybe it didn't take me 50 years to learn, but it certainly stood well throughout my career by thinking like a customer.
So is there an example of when thinking like a customer led to a business success?
Look, I think it's a cumulative thing, Jeffrey. I remember an example when I was at David Jones, we used to award merit pins to sales staff who had excelled in their role. And there was one time I awarded a merit pin to a sales assistant who actually, the customer had come into the men's shoe department, wanted a size 10 and a half floor shoe. They only had a size 10. The sales assistant said to the customer, here is a coffee voucher, go and have a coffee, come back in 15 minutes and I'll have the size 10 and a half. So the sales assistant took the size 10 shoes under his arm, walked out of the shop down to the, you may not recall, the Hilton Arcade, there was a floor shoe shop there, said, can I exchange the size 10 for a 10 and a half? They did that, he brought the shoes back into the store, and the customer was then able to buy those shoes after having a cup of coffee. Now, security wanted to dismiss that employee because he broke all the rules by taking stock out of the store, not going through the proper paperwork and staff entrance. But that sales assistant only had the customer and the interest of the customer at heart, even though they broke all sorts of rules. So again, it was that example of just going that little bit extra and really meeting that customer service expectation. So I've used that example over the years to demonstrate that whilst big organizations need to have rules and need to have processes, from time to time, you have to ensure that people feel comfortable in stepping outside those processes if it means they're going to really deliver exceptional service to the customer.
But the challenge there obviously is balancing policies, procedures and the process that you set up in place with the customer centricity culture. And I can certainly attest to that, you know, through my time at Telstra when David Thodey was the helm, customer was the center of everything that we do. Basically being empowered to cite the customer as a reason for why we need to do what we did, that was certainly a very powerful experience when we can override bureaucracy and procedures in place. That I definitely agree with that. But how do you find that balance where when you think like a customer, you don't at the same time create all sorts of dramas and breaking all sorts of processes in order to do so?
Yeah, it is a balancing act, Jeffrey, I grant you. Running big organizations, you do need process and structure and discipline. My experience has been that it is still of greater value to the organization if your employees at every level within the organization feel that they can step outside those processes if it means really delivering exceptional service and meeting the customer's expectations. But it has to be a balance. You can't have a free-for-all. You can't have anarchy within the organization. But I think it's a risk that is worth taking. Conversely, you end up in a very bureaucratic style of enterprise. My experience is that you're better to encourage initiative, encourage that customer centricity, even if it is at the expense of a little bit of control and discipline.
Yep. Which leads me to the next point, listen and understand the customer's needs.
Yeah, look, this is about, and it probably relates to more my time when I was I was the CEO of Tempo Services, and then my time with Telstra, where you're actually selling a service and you're selling an ongoing relationship with the customer. It's not like you're selling a product or an item. When in a service-related industry, it is absolutely essential to really understand the customer value proposition. And I know you and I spent some time when we were at Telstra working and workshopping with customers to really try to understand how, in those days, technology-related solutions would add value to the customer's business through customer relationship, through employee productivity, through cost efficiencies, and so forth. So it is really about listening and understanding, being curious, really digging into what is the value proposition that your service or your solution will add to the customer. And that means you've got to, in some ways, put yourself in the customer's shoes to really understand the nature of their business, what are their key drivers, what are their key measures of success, and so forth. And if you can understand that and then apply your solution to drive those metrics, that's when you're more likely to get the customer to be receptive and to favor your solution over potentially others that are in the market. That's where I'm coming from and that with that particular lesson.
So it sounds like you have to be ability to have that empathy for the customer's situation, like you say, put yourself in the customer's shoes. But is that something that could be learnt?
I think so. Quite often, Jeffrey, it comes back to your own understanding of business acumen, your own understanding of how you can change the metrics or how you can change the performance of the organization by doing things in a different way.
But that's assuming you know the drivers of your customer's business. You know, what if those drivers aren't transparent to you?
Yes, it does, but that can be learned. I mean, you can... Quite often you can access their balance sheet, or you can access if it's a public company, their records are fairly easy to access. Or you can ask questions. You can actually inquire in terms of what are their key drivers, what are the key metrics of success in the organization. And as I say, then apply your own business acumen skills to try and interpret those drivers and then apply your particular solution in terms of how it may improve those metrics. So I think it is something that can be learned. And again, it's a matter of being curious and asking questions, but asking the right questions. Most importantly is to listen to the answer that you're getting so that you're not just fixated on delivering your particular solution, but you are able to really identify, well, maybe my solution is not the best in this particular instance, and be prepared to be honest and be prepared to be transparent with the customer and say, in this particular instance, you may be better to look at another alternative solution to mine.
And that takes a lot of integrity, a lot of character to be able to walk away from a business like that.
Oh, most definitely. But again, it gets back to that other lesson that one about, under promise and over deliver. There is no point in trying to sell something that you feel may not necessarily meet the need of a customer. And that, of course, will then lead to a breach of trust and credibility, as we discussed a little earlier.
Absolutely. So the next one sounds like something that came out of The Godfather. Business is not personal. Can you explain that one, please?
Yeah, look, as you mentioned earlier, I'm doing some coaching and mentoring, and this typically comes up quite often in discussions with the people that I work with. I learned very early in my career, Jeffrey, and it's been reinforced during my career, that business is not personal. Mm-hmm. It can be an instance of rejection in terms of your sales activities and your sales efforts not being accepted by the customer. As mm-hmm. we said before, there are always more fish in the ocean, but to not take that rejection personally, but to say this is business. It's very relevant from a customer-related perspective, but also from one of leadership. Over my career, I have at various times had to have some difficult discussions with direct reports in terms of either their performance or their lack of judgment or their behaviours. And they're always difficult discussions to have. But if you think or if you accept that business is not personal, then it makes that discussion far more constructive, a little easier to have. And certainly over my career, it's been something that has helped me certainly deal with either rejection or to deal with having those quite difficult discussions. So I say to my people I work with that leadership is not a popularity contest. Mm-hmm. You are there to do a job. You've been entrusted to manage the assets of an organization on behalf of the owner or the shareholder. And it is your responsibility to do the best you can in terms of the return that you make on those assets. And from time to time, that means that you've got to have some difficult discussions.
So that means that you've probably got to put aside your own personal relationships with particular individuals in order to act in the best interest of the company. Now, that could be a very difficult balancing act. How do you balance that with the need for, let's say, loyalty to the people in your lives?
Yeah, that's a very good question and astute observation, Jeffrey. And it's unfortunate that you do have to have a separation between friendship and business relationship. I used to talk about maintaining a gap between you and your direct reports, which means that you still are looking to have a constructive, effective working relationship with them. It means that you can still have empathy and show a bit of vulnerability by sharing personal related issues. But at the end of the day, you, by the nature of your position as the leader of the organization, you may be required from time to have those difficult discussions. So you do have to have that separation of personal relationship with your direct report and your business relationship. So it's a fine line. Unfortunately, that's why quite often, you know, you would have heard the phrase, it's lonely at the top. Mm. And indeed it is, because sometimes there are certain things that you just cannot share with your direct reports in the interest of confidentiality or the interest of just the management responsibility to the organization. But yes, it is a fine line. It's not black and white. It's one of those shades of grey.
Well, this is why it's the wisdom that took 50 years to learn.
that's true.
So the next one you've got, consistency is the key to effective team leadership.
Yes, look, I've been asked over the years, you know, what's the number one trait for good leaders or good CEOs? I always say the number one trait, in my view, is consistency. Mm-hmm. And I've over the years worked with or worked for leaders. And I mean, you mentioned David Thodey earlier. David Thodey is a very consistent leader in terms of his behaviors, in terms of his values, in terms of his strategy. You knew that each day he came into the office, he was going to be consistent in terms of his expectations compared to the group. Now, I won't name the name, but there was a previous CEO of Telstra who was the opposite. One day he'd come in and it was black, and the next day he'd come in and it was white. So people working for leaders who are inconsistent do not have clarity around the expectation of the leader, or don't have clarity around what strategy is going to be appropriate. So as a consequence, the organization starts to slow its inertia, because executives don't feel comfortable in making decisions, because today they might make the right decision, but tomorrow they might make the same decision, but it'll be wrong in the eyes of the leader. If you've got consistency, then you're able to get a far greater level of empowerment in the organization. You're getting people who are prepared to make decisions, knowing that they're consistent with, or sorry, knowing that they're in accordance with the consistency of the leader. So in my view, and over the years, you can be a very hard leader. Mm-hmm. You can be extremely demanding, or you can be someone who's got much soft skills. As long as you're consistent one day with the next, mm-hmm. then people working with you will know what is expected of them. And that means that they're able to take initiative and they're able to contribute to the organization. And importantly, they're able to feel empowered to make decisions on behalf of the organization. So consistency of the leader is absolutely critical.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like what you're saying is that leaders have to be congruent in terms of their words, their actions, in order for the value to flow throughout the organization. But leaders also have to be consistent over time so that you do have a congruent expectation of what the leader will do and how he will respond. And that allows the team to have a framework by which they can then act consistently with what the leader's, I suppose, value set and demands are in order to action that. But what about, is there room for growth? Because, I mean, all of us, everyone, as leaders, we tend to grow with the situation as well. Doesn't that introduce some inconsistency, I suppose, as you try to become a better leader?
No, I don't believe so. Every individual typically has got a slightly different leadership style. Mm-hmm. So I think it can still be your own person in terms of your leadership capabilities and aspirations. But the lesson or the message I'm suggesting is that you've got to be consistent in those behaviors, mm-hmm. and you've got to be consistent in the values that you have, so that people working for you are able to understand your expectations and then make decisions, or for them to then have behaviors that meet those expectations. So I don't see it being an opposing issue, Jeff.
What you're saying is that the values don't change even as you evolve as a leader. The underlying things that are non-compromisable should not change even as you evolve in your leadership journey.
That's a good interpretation. Yes, most definitely.
The next one I love, no, and the reason I love this is because it's a sporting analogy. Know when to transition from a captain coach to sideline coach.
Yeah, this is a lesson that I learned probably in my early days of David Jones, mm-hmm. when I was, as you mentioned earlier, I was relatively young for the position that I held. And typically you can lapse into thinking that you are the super executive, you are the only person who can make the right decision. And whilst you're responsible for the organization and you want to make sure that decisions are made correctly, the reality is you can't do everything yourself. If the business is going to continue to grow, then you have to know when to get off the field. And typically, as businesses are growing, you're on the field, leading by example, rallying your team, demonstrating that you're prepared to do anything that you're asking them to do. But as the business grows, typically there's someone else that can do your position or can play in your position better than you can. Mm-hmm. And your skill sets are better served by getting off the field and starting to manage and coach from the sideline. So you're able to identify what it is your competitors are doing, how your players are performing in each of their different roles, and what's the strategy that potentially should be adopted to improve performance against your competitors. But the important piece, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I talk quite often about square pegs and round holes, or round pegs and square holes. And that's where you, as the leader, need to ensure that you've got the right person in the right position. And that's a constant process of assessment and a constant process of adjustment. And if you can get all the square pegs in the square holes and the round pegs in the round holes, then the business is likely to really continue to power forward. But knowing when to get off the field is a critical one. And a lot of business leaders, business owners struggle with letting go and actually getting off the field and employing people that can actually perform various roles in the organization, allowing them to be able to have more headspace to focus on strategy and focus on supporting the growth of the business. So that's what I'm meaning there by transitioning from captain coach to sideline coach.
So it sounds like there was a point of realization earlier on in your career when you're promoted to the managing director role at David Jones. You know, is there a story about how you came to that realization that you need to be sideline coach?
I remember I was responsible for a New South Wales operations. And this is before I was appointed as managing director. I ran the operations in New South Wales, and then I was given the role of the national operations manager. And I felt that I could perform both the role of New South Wales as well as the operations manager, as well as the national manager. But I remember thinking to myself, driving home one evening from the office, that I actually found myself in a position where I was not giving adequate consideration and thought to problems or challenges during the day. And I was making decisions on the run to the point where I was really quite concerned that they weren't the right decisions because I hadn't given sufficient thought. So I realized then that I had to let go. I had to empower, I had to delegate, I had to engage others to help me actually find that time to have the headspace to think about bigger issues in more depth and detail. So it was that was one. And another one I remember when I was responsible for the buying operations in the business. And again, crusty old ex-executive said to me, do not be the super buyer. You cannot hold people accountable if you're actually telling them what they should be buying. You've actually got to let people who have the right skill sets to do their job, and then you can monitor and manage their performance based on outcomes. Whereas if you tell them what to do, then they say, well, how can you know, don't hold me accountable. You've told me what I should be doing. So a couple of examples. It's just a matter of being prepared to delegate and to empower people to make decisions for you then to focus on more strategic issues in the organization.
And it certainly sounds like that's related to the next lesson, which is self-awareness underpins humility.
Yeah, this one, and again, don't want to be too many cliches, Jeffrey, but you've heard people say, park your ego outside the office. I've been fortunate over the years that I've had positions of responsibility at a relatively young age, and I learned very early, I meant that back in those days of running a concrete plant at age 24, that just by nature of your title or your position, you cannot demand authority. You have to, and it was very clear, I had a dozen owner drivers in concrete lorry drivers, and I had a couple of other people I was responsible for. At age 24, they sort of said, well, who's this young fella telling us what to do? I learned very early on that you've actually got to earn authority. You can't demand authority. And that comes from having a good level of self-awareness. And over the years, and probably you've experienced it as well, some business leaders, their egos get in the way. Good leaders, in my view, have got a good, strong sense of humility about them. They have this self-awareness where they realize that they don't have the answers to everything. They do recognize that they've got some areas of weakness. Conversely, most of them have got some very areas of strength and capability. But if you have a good sense of self-awareness, then it means that you're always looking to learn, you're prepared to listen to the views of others, you're prepared to take into consideration all of the various issues associated with decision-making, and then come to hopefully the right logical conclusion, having taken into account all of those variables. So that's where I'm coming from there. It's certainly in my career, being prepared to recognize that I don't know everything, and being prepared to continue to learn, and being prepared to, if a decision is made that is the wrong decision, to then recognize it's the wrong decision and be prepared to change course. Sometimes you'll see decisions are made and egos get in the way and they will not change that decision, even though it's clear that it's the wrong decision. That's that level of self-awareness.
That's true. And humility is one of the most undervalued virtues, in my opinion, especially I find in the Western sphere. Certainly something that I think we can do with a lot more of in order for us to make better decisions. Which leads me to the next point, that you're saying that good judgment is both inherent and comes with experience. Now, I really, really like this one. Can you tell me a bit more?
It's something that you can't actually, in my view, read a textbook to learn good judgment. And I've been asked quite a few times over my career, what is judgment or how do you develop judgment? I find that it really relates back to, and both in a personal sense, but also in a corporate sense. It's a combination of standards that you set for yourself and for the organization, and also combination of the values that you set both personally and for the organization. And it's something that comes throughout your entire lifetime. And I don't think you ever stop developing better judgment, because as you progress through your career and obviously through your own life experiences, be it with children or grandchildren or parents or whatever, then you experience instances of good judgment and poor judgment. Observation of poor judgment is just as important and useful as observation of good judgment.
Good judgment, yeah.
So that's the experience piece that comes through. But I also believe that there is an inherent nature to judgment. Mm-hmm. But that comes back to your own personal values and standards. And as you mentioned earlier, including humility and being prepared to have that level of self-awareness. It's not black and white, and you can't get it out of a textbook. And sometimes I have difficulty in articulating it, but developing good judgment is a lifetime experience. When you see, and I mean, you look at some politicians and you look at some business leaders and even this recent thing with ASIC and so forth, it can be part of, does it pass the pub test? And that can be a judgment related thing as well. Good leaders typically demonstrate good judgment by applying their own personal standards, the expectations of the organizational standard, but then the values, both your personal values and the values of the organization. And shared values creates the culture of this.
So this sounds like an age-old argument, you know, are good leaders born or are they made? You know, is it nature versus nurture? So I'm going to throw a curveball at you. So if you were not born with the right values, can you learn to have the right values with experience?
I think it is a harder challenge, but I think if you have a good level of self-awareness, then you can, Jeffrey.
So people's characters can fundamentally change.
They can, but my experience has been that you can change behaviors through different incentives or through different encouragement and support and so forth. But changing character is harder, much harder. The probability of changing character is in some cases relatively low. And certainly in my experience, and I'm seeing increasingly with organizations in 2020, they're employing based on an individual's values and the individual's empathy, with the understanding that they're going to teach them new skills and teach them capabilities. But to employ someone into an organization that doesn't share the values and doesn't have the empathy with the organization is very high risk and quite often doesn't work out. So I'm not saying you can't, but I'm saying it is much harder.
That's interesting. And I tend to agree based on my lived experience as well. The next one, always treat the business assets as of your own. So now this is interesting because I would have thought that your own assets would have a very different set of parameters and risk profiles. Why would you encourage businesses to treat business decisions as if they were personal decisions?
Well, again, it comes back, I mentioned a little earlier, that as the leader of an organization, you're entrusted to manage the assets of the organization in the best interest of the shareholder. To do that, my experience has been, and what I've learned, is if I make decisions based on the allocation of those assets as if they were my own assets, then I'm more likely to be comfortable in being accountable for how I allocate those assets. I think in terms of risk profile, quite often that is determined by boards And obviously, if it is a significant investment, then business cases have to be prepared and return on equity or return on investment or whatever. One of the reasons I put this commentary down is in respect to getting a culture of accountability within an organization. And when I was in retail, we had department managers. It may be a manager responsible for ladies' shoes. And the best department managers treated each of those departments as if it was their own business. They felt that the customers were their customers. They felt the stock was their stock. The staff was their staff. And as a consequence, you get this culture of accountability right down into the organization. As someone responsible over the years for public company businesses as well as private, I've found that if you're going to get good outcomes, you've got to get that ownership of outcomes. And that comes with the accountability. I used to say to executives at the time, if you need to make a call in terms of the allocation of an asset or the expenditure of company's money, ask yourself, if this was your company or this was your business, would you spend the money that way? It's really this sense of accountability. And I do see sometimes, particularly larger organizations, that we spoke a little earlier about, you know, you've got to have disciplines and structure and processes and so forth. But I do see some instances of abrogation of accountability. If you don't have ownership within organizations by those making the decisions, then in my view, you're not going to get the best outcomes.
Which leads us to the last lesson. Now, again, this sounds a little bit cliched, to be patient, persistent, and positive. Can you tell us a bit more about that mindset?
Again, Jeffrey, I mean, it might sound a bit cliche, but this is both relating to personal life as well as business life. And the number one thing I think is if you're a leader or in your own family context, optimism is very powerful. The focus on the glass half full and the glass not being half empty. Certainly in a leadership environment, it gives comfort, it gives a level of teamwork and support if you are in a position where you're prepared to be patient. And again, it can be in a customer-related situation or it can be in terms of executing on strategy. It is a matter of being persistent, it's a matter of being patient, and particularly one of being positive. So that people don't feel despondent or they don't feel rejection or they don't feel that they're not part of a successful organization. Whereas if you're able to calmly and persistently pursue the strategy of the business with this sense of optimism, not unrealism, but optimism, then you're more likely to create can-do culture and this culture that we're part of a successful organization that is actually moving forward. And everyone in business typically wants to be part of a successful organization. But they look to the leader for that sort of example, that the behaviors that are positive and behaviors that are reassuring in terms of the organization making progress.
Because it speaks to something much deeper in all of us, isn't it? It's that need. I think what it points to is a culture of hope. It's a culture of, you know, optimism and hope. And we are all drawn to that. We want to be part of that. And I think that makes absolute sense because as human beings, you know, this is the way we are programmed.
Most definitely.
Thank you. Rod, this has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, and I certainly have enjoyed your lessons. As you know, I've always thought of you as a mentor and I have immense respect for you. So thank you very much for continuing to guide me and my leadership journey. So appreciate that and always being so generous with your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jeffrey. Always good to spend some time with you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you. And you've been listening to the international podcast of 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn, sponsored by the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, parties. You can find us on www.professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And here's the best part. It's all free. Thank you.